This is HPR episode 1933 entitled, HPR Audiobook Club 11 Street Candles, and is part of the series, HPR Audiobook Club. It is hosted by HPR Audiobook Club, and is about 134 minutes long. The summary is, in this episode, the HPR Audiobook Club reviews Street Candles by David Collins Rivera.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by AnHonestHost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Hacker Public Radio. Today, you've got another episode of the Hacker Public Radio Audiobook Club. My name is Pokey, and I will be one of your co-hosts today. With me as well is the ever-popular Crispy 150.
Howdy, folks.
We got my buddy Pegwall.
Hey, hey.
We got Super Taj.
What's good, everybody?
And X1101, who I can't stop saying that now, even though I really want to say X1101 for speed.
Well, I ask you for saying it the way that everyone is supposed to think it.
Right on. And how you doing, buddy?
Doing good. Doing good.
Good. So, I'll say it right at the beginning this time, so I don't have to interrupt our flow of conversation like I do every time. This is the Hacker Public Radio Audiobook Club, in which we review an audiobook for the episode that we've all listened to. Just in case this is your first one, the rules for the book club are that it has to be a freely available audio file, and that means free of cost, free as in beer. We want something that everyone or anyone on earth who wishes to listen or participate with our show can do so. Once we finish listening to the book, we do the review show here. We're using all free software, and this is free as in freedom, free as in speech, as well as happens to be free as in beer, because we're using Mumble. And during the show, we'll do kind of a review with no spoilers. We'll just get in and say what we think about the book, the production, the audio files, that kind of thing, without any spoilers. We'll take a break midway through the show, in which we will each review a beverage of our own choosing. And then after our beverage review section, we continue reviewing the audiobook, but we spoil it at that point. So if you have not yet listened to this audiobook and you would like to do so, feel free to stop this now and listen to the audiobook. It's a good one. And then come back to us. Or you can listen to us right up and through the beverage review and then stop after that so we don't spoil the book on you. Because we will certainly wait until after the beverage review to spoil it on you. And that's that for now. Did I miss anything, guys?
Sounds like the plan.
Yep.
Let's roll.
Okay, so the book that we're reviewing tonight, the audiobook that we're reviewing tonight, is Street Candles by David Collins Rivera. And he is also well known in our community as Lost in Bronx. He's a Hacker Public Radio contributor. He's authored several audiobooks and I guess internet radio series that you may be familiar with, depending on how long you've been part of the community and how into the Hacker Public Radio and the Oddcast Planet community you are. This is the second book in the series. The first one was called Motherlode, and it's a short one, but both of these are standalone, so you didn't have to listen to Motherlode to listen to this. He's also done the Eddie K series and a couple other things. So Yeah, that's that. We all decided to do this one. Everybody was excited for it. Everybody loves Lost in Bronx. He's a great guy, and everybody seems to like his writing so far up until this book, and I guess we'll find out what we thought of this book now. Taj, what'd you think?
So I read Mother Lode when it came out, and I was like, eh, you know, it's pretty good. You know, Lost in Bronx wrote a book. That's cool. I dig it. Wasn't too terribly excited about it, but I thought it was a good first crack at something new. So when Street Candles came out, I kind of ignored it and, you know, just didn't pay much attention to it. And then I heard everybody talking about it and how good it was. So I was like, okay, we're going to do it. So I sat down and listened to it, and probably the first five chapters, I was like, yeah, you know, this is pretty similar. Everything's going down. It's about a crew in space. And then, something happens and I'm like, damn, this book is awesome. I was telling, I think it was 5150. I was telling that it, a testament to how good the end of this book is that I actually listened to the last chapter in real time, which for me is like practically a sin.
Yeah. Nice. X1101. How about it?
I loved it so much. I listened to it twice.
Yeah, I did too. I'm dying to hear what you thought of this book, Pegwolf.
It was a fantastic postmodern essay on life. That's what I think it was.
Really? In what way did you find it paralleling your own life or the lives of people you know and love?
Many different ways. I absolutely loved it, and I cannot recommend it enough.
And see, now I thought it was more modern than postmodern. How so? Do you see it going beyond what we know today and understand the meaning of life to be?
Because I listened to the wrong damn audiobook, and I'm completely talking out of my ass.
Womp womp.
I will be surprised if I did not wake my child up with as much as I was laughing right there.
Push to chuckle, X1101. Push to chuckle.
We have to trademark that.
But I don't chuckle. I cackle at the top of my lungs.
You can push to cackle, push to guffaw, whatever you like.
I'm a fan of Push to Chortle myself.
Oh, poor Pegwolf listened to next month's book already. Maybe he was he was so excited because he's the one that picked our next book. So you haven't listened to Street Candles yet?
No.
Oh, you poor soul.
I think I can speak for everyone else here. If you're listening to this show in the future and you haven't listened to Street Candles, pause the show right now. Go download Street Candles and listen to it, because it's so much incredibly better than anything that we could think of to say about it.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I think you nailed it. It's absolutely fantastic. This is, I don't even think we said what it is yet. It's a science fiction genre. Space opera is what everybody calls it, though. I don't think I could define that word for you if I was asked to, but this is...
I do not recall there being any opera. No.
No, you might be right. But anyway, I mean, this was a science fiction adventure. It was action-based. It was very fast-paced. Almost... I've listened to it twice now. The first time I listened to it, it seemed epically long, but that may just be because he was releasing it a chapter a week, so it took a lot of real time to listen to it. The second time through, I flashbaked it as quick as I could, and it took me maybe 3 days, because it is still pretty long, and it's worth every second that you spend on it.
I flashbaked it right after, or actually started before the last book club, and then again last week. And just, wow.
Well, you know, it's the type of book, you know, it's an audio book, you know when it's over, because the music comes up at the end. Every time that happens, you know, I'm shaking my fist at Lost in Bronx and saying, oh, you bastard.
Yeah, I know that I know he had originally done this as like a podcast and it came out once, I guess, a week or something like that. I wasn't around when that, well, I was around. I just wasn't paying attention when that happened. I would have not been able to handle that.
I very much concur. The man perfected the art of a cliffhanger to the point where it would have driven me crazier.
That's what I was about to say, too. He's a master of the cliffhanger. I think, was it maybe 45 or 47 chapters long, and maybe three of them. I was like, okay, I better stop now or I'm not going to sleep tonight. There was only three that were not, you know, cliffhangers that I couldn't put down. Another thing I can say about it right off the bat without any spoilers was I found the main character's adventure, I didn't even realize it the first time through, but I found it so engaging that the second time through, during the first few chapters, and I've never had this feeling before while listening to an audiobook, and it's the kind of feeling you get as a little kid when you're watching a movie, and I kept like saying to myself, no, don't go do that. No, don't do that. No, that's going to lead you down the wrong road. No, just turn around. I've never had that feeling before with an audiobook. Like, no, we'll have to go through this again. We can't do it.
One of the things about this book that I noticed is it really makes me want to go back and read the first book again, because I think now, because that first book is so short, it's kind of hard to get a kind of a bead on the character. And now that I know so much more about him, I think that first book would be a whole lot more interesting.
Can confirm. I listened to Street Candles, and then I went back and listened to Motherlode and then Street Candles all straight through. And I guess I can't say I got more out of it, since I didn't get anything out of it the first time because there was no first time. But I definitely think knowing the character, it felt more like just another episode of his life listening to Motherlode.
That's interesting. I hadn't even thought to do that. I don't know why I hadn't, but yeah, it is short. I don't listen to many things twice unless it's for the book club, so I guess I just didn't think to do that.
I have a thing with rereading actual books. I mean, for me, it's this weird, like, I almost feel like I'm visiting old friends and doing the things we've always done. It's kind of the nostalgic vibe I get from it. Even though you know what's happening, it's, you know, enjoying all of the detail even more. And I, even though it was less than a month apart, I definitely still had that same feeling. I will probably listen to this again several times in my life. Even though it is so massive, it will be an undertaking.
Oh, he had such detail in this book. Such subtle little things that painted entire pictures with just a few words. You know, I think it's not a spoiler to say that there was some conflict in this book, and there was a struggle for the main character, and a lot of the people around him were living in desolation. And he at one point in one of the later chapters, he describes a scene as he goes through it. And then a couple chapters later, he comes back and he just simply says, when I went back through, the same people were there, or at least they were similar enough that I didn't notice, or something like that. It's some wording like that. And I just thought that was brilliant. Like, that knocked me out of my chair. I loved it.
One of the things that I'm interested to see is, if you take this book and you put it on a shelf and just kind of let it sit there for 10 years, how well it will hold up. I'm sure it will hold up because it's a good story, but I mean, there's so much in this book that is of right now, or at least kind of the last 10 years that is kind of extrapolated out. I wonder how much it will resonate, or if it's just really resonant right now. I know for me, I was completely just drawing parallels to just the situation in the world right now.
Well, I think what you're referring to a lot of is Zizek. You know, a lot of the solutions that he comes up with to be better in his job, and I guess we should tell people he's a professional gunner, which is, you know, in this space opera future, you know, you have unions like you would now for ships, and people will, you know, have different qualifications and get hired through a union hall or get hired off the web or whatever, make applications through the web. But he's a professional gunner, so usually nobody else on a small ship knows. But they only have one. Well, he'd be like the security person. He'd be like Worf on Star Trek, though not exactly.
He didn't say the word dishonorable even once.
But I think, get back to my original point, Izhak, a lot of comes up with. I mean, he's not just taking the stock items and the stock software. He's out there hunting the web. You know, he's always coming up with combat scenarios that he's running through on the equipment. And so he's pulling from all these different sources. Every time he saves a file, and a lot of times files he's saving are not necessarily completely legitimate. In other words, stuff is still copyrighted in the future. And sometimes he's pulling stuff off there that people posted to, I guess, the 30th century equivalent to torrents. And going through them and seeing what if he doesn't think it'll ever apply to a situation he could use it in, he's looking at it and taking it apart to see if there's something he could learn. So, I mean, anybody who does IT work or programming or whatever, none of us would be successful today without the modern internet, because we don't have the total knowledge of how everything works in our minds as we go through our jobs. I mean, we know how to use the tools out there on the web to find out the things that we don't know. I mean, I was a math major in school, and they wouldn't let us bring any of the higher math algorithms into a test with us. And I even had a graduate assistant once say, in class, he's teaching the classes, "I don't know why they make you memorize this stuff. You're not being paid to memorize this stuff. You're being paid to know where to go look it up." And the same thing out there. You know, anybody works in IT, we come up with practically every job is a new situation, something we haven't quite seen before, and you've got to go out and hit Google and hit the manufacturer's website and learn what it is you're supposed to do. And that's so perfectly replicated in this story.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. The other thing is the whole universe that was created for this is reminiscent for me of the universe created in Joss Whedon's Firefly. Different enough that I would say that there's no, you know, direct ripoff or anything. It's a similar version of the future.
Now, I'm surprised, and maybe you've not read Nathan Lowell's books, but I was, you know, I kept thinking this, and I'm not saying that it's not original, but it seems like in Nathan Lowell's universe, either a few hundred years before or a few hundred years after, because they're not using the solar sails for propulsion, but a lot of the other things, are similar. There's no such thing as subspace communication, and that ships, you know, have to drop into a solar system far, far out of the gravity well. There are plotted points that are the appropriate place to drop in, just out of hyperspace into the solar system. But then the first thing you do is make contact with the planet, and you upload essentially the contents of their internet and download the contents of what you have of the universal internet. So, in other words, messages between planets might be delayed by months because they can only go so fast as the ships can go.
It's like the whole galaxy running on a whole bunch of Arsync.
Yeah, very much so, actually. Now, I'm glad you brought that up, 50, because I was going to bring that up as well. I did get a little bit of a feel of Firefly from this. Not a whole lot, just a little, just enough, just a little sprinkling of spice in there, and it was good. And I did not find many similarities to Nathan Lowell's universe, even though I was kind of looking for them, because Lost in Bronx used some similar verbiage in this book. And I don't know if that's because they're common words in current sci-fi writing, or if it's because Nathan Lowell just did such a good job naming you know, putting a real specific name to a certain event or a certain procedure. I think he used some similar words. And yeah, the gravity well was similar, but I easily can see like parallel invention on that. The jump points, again, once you're out of the gravity well, that's pretty similar. I didn't see a whole lot of parallel between this and Nathan Lowell other than some verbiage.
And a lot of the concepts also pop up in, you know, Star Wars Extended Universe when you're talking about gravity wells and jumping in and out of a system and dealing with mass shadows and things like that. It almost feels like the middle ground between the Firefly universe and the Star Wars universe, if I had to pick a technological settings thing to generalize it as.
Yeah, I just read a lot of science fiction books. I don't know. It didn't seem very unique to me. I think that there's really, you can kind of break books down into like, you know, three faster than light travel methods and books just pick one and go with it. So, I mean, this seemed pretty standard to anything that kind of uses what I assume to be some sort of hyperspace dealio to get from, you know, to bypass faster than light. So I didn't see anything remotely too different from other books that use the same mechanism.
I like that while they were traveling in hyperspace, time passed for them, even though to the outside observer, it was an instantaneous jump. Is that fairly common to other books as well, or was that unique to this?
Not in the, in my limited sci-fi experience, I've not seen that before. I've seen it as more of a parallel, you know, you are jumping as long as you're jumping. There's no time differential. And if you think about it a little bit this way, seems to make a little more sense.
Yeah, my understanding of like, you know, baseline physics and then science fiction physics on top of that is that like the whole idea of hyperspace is you're basically punching into another subdimension where time and space are arranged in a different fashion. And so things, it would probably still take time to get from one place to another, but it may be a shorter distance or time may pass differently inside that other dimension. And then when you pop back out, you go back into real space. So, I mean, it would make, to me, it would make sense that it traveling through that hyperspace would take time to them. Now, I guess if you pop out of one reality and pop back in, maybe that takes no time, but I don't think there's like a standard way of dealing with it.
I liked it either way. I thought it was interesting. It was one layer deeper than the actual story to think about. You know what I mean? And I like when books provoke thought.
Well, and I liked a lot of mechanisms like that. The faster than light travel and other technical details. We got enough of it to kind of extrapolate what the picture was without going into nuts and bolts. But at the same time, it seemed ubiquitous enough that the characters are like, oh, it just works that way.
You like the food?
No.
I hate to keep going back to the first book, but I think part of the reason that I wasn't too keen on the first book, like I liked it, but you know, it wasn't all that to me, was it was basically a couple ships, you know, sublight in space dealing with issues, which is a great story, but if you're looking for like space operas, probably not exactly what you're thinking of. And I would argue that this book isn't exactly what you're thinking of, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I kept finding like he would mention things in Street Candles and just like not explain it, and then you got a better picture of it like as it went on. Like you didn't have to explain it. It was definitely like show don't tell. Like you got an idea that, oh, all these people that have this same accent are from this same group, and like you never have to say that, but you just keep meeting people, and then it starts to like coalesce. Like if you got dropped in the middle of a foreign country and you know you had to learn about all these different ethnic groups that were there, unless you had a tour guide, nobody's going to tell you. You're just gonna have to figure it out. And it was very natural. I kind of like that about it.
That's a much more succinct way of saying what I meant.
I loved the names of the languages. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I definitely see classes in low speak in Ejok's future.
And quite possibly Seishan.
Yeah, I loved Inglis and Seishan. I thought that was fantastic. Just the subtle change.
Of course, knowing Ejok, he probably figures he's never ever going to set foot on a planet again. That's one of the things about the character. He may have been born on a planet, but he hasn't spent a whole lot of time on one since.
Uh, that doesn't seem – I seem to recall him being born on a space station. So still in a gravity well, but not on the actual planet.
Yeah, he went out of his way to say he didn't like planets, never felt comfortable on them.
The specific language in that sentence was really – it evoked – you could almost feel what he felt about it. It was well done.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at one point I think that might be a spoiler. You know, it wasn't a spoiler, and I emailed Lost in Bronx about this to mention it. The audio quality is fantastic on this. I mean, he really spent some time getting everything perfect. Everything is perfectly documented as well, because everything that he used that was not his own was licensed Creative Commons. He's released this Creative Commons, I think, just by SA. You can even use this for commercial purposes. Fantastic. He crossed every T, dotted every I to put out the absolute best product, not just that he could, but the best product possible. I mean, I know in speaking to him in the past, he custom built his operating system specifically for producing ebooks and audiobooks. He learned text editors. He learned audio editors. He learned tag editors. I mean, he went out of his way to put together the absolute best product that could be put together. And the only criticism that I could find as far as the quality of the writing, the sound, everything, was that if I was listening late at night, sometimes when the chapters would change from one to the next, the music came on a bit loud in the next chapter and it might startle me awake again. That's the only nitpicking detail that I could pick out of this quality wise to criticize. It's the only criticism I can find, other than one particular one in the story, which should be a spoiler and I'll have to talk about it later.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm really worried about this book. Is it is so good and it is so long, and I've heard him talk about like the process, like Pokey was talking about. I'm afraid that this took it all out of him, and it's going to be a really long time before we get the next book. I hope I'm wrong, because I really want a sequel.
Yeah. To add to what Pokey was saying with the quality, I agree that it was really, really fantastic. When we first decided on listening to this book, I went to go grab it, and the RSS feeds were broke. They did not work. And a couple of us mentioned it on the HPR mailing list, and I want to say it was David Whitman, maybe, who fixed it before I got a chance to. But we both sent Lost in Bronx corrected feeds, and you know, almost instantly it was up, corrected, and usable again. That was nice.
Yeah, that was the same day. That was a same day fix, and it was the day after we announced it on the mailing list.
Well, one thing I wanted to say, our friend Ken Fallon, he criticized Shaman's Tale because he didn't think that the in the story were evil enough. And all I can say is, Ken, you missed your perfect opportunity to be on the book club, because the corporations in this one are right bastards.
Yeah, you get that right.
I'm pretty sure that's in the requirements for becoming a corporation.
Yeah, you get that right.
No soul, check, can be a corporation.
I mean, not even the Chinese make the poor conscripted children workers live between the machinery the way they do in this story.
And yet, life aboard the ship sounded pretty good. You know, it didn't sound bad. You know, I mean, it's not like what we're used to today, but it didn't sound terrible, you know, especially compared to, you know, the station and the planet side life.
I mean, it didn't sound, but it sounded like, you know, you worked hard and were rewarded.
Well, you know, and the part of the book was Ejok's loyalties. I mean, he felt sorry for the way the workers were treated on this world. But even so, he could not condone the incredible cruelty and savagery that they visited upon the people they perceived as being their masters. And, you know, I thought maybe that could have been fleshed out a little bit. All fairly early in the book, and I won't say who it was, you guys all know that Ejok encounters someone whose sympathies lie with the workers, and this person was surprised to learn Ejok was not an owner of the ship. He was just hired on as a worker, and thought, well, Ejok loyalties ought to be entirely with us. It was all black or white for this other character, and I would have gone into a little bit, even the people I work for, they're owners, but, you know, they're mortgaged up to the hilt. And if anything goes wrong, they lose their shirts and the ship too. So that it's not like they're, living the life of Riley out there on the ship. They're essentially, living under the same conditions all the crew members are.
That's almost commentary of the difference between, a small business owner and a corporation. They both may technically own the business, but one of them's got a little more skin in the game.
Todd, you're lit up, but I don't hear you. Can everybody hear me and or Todd?
I can hear Pokey.
I do as well.
I hear everyone but Todd.
I think, hasn't Todd had this problem before on this server?
How about now?
There you go.
Unplug and plug back in fixes most things.
Have you tried turning it off and on again?
Or crashes them.
I literally have that as my signature on my email at work, so that's usually my first reply. Anyways, like I was saying, I thought that was, without going into the spoiler realm, I thought that was one of the really cool things about the book, is that it is very careful to never set its foot solidly on one side of anything. It's always kind of in the middle, and I think a little more realistic that way.
Well, it does a good job illustrating that every situation, no matter how black and white you might feel it is, has plenty of gray.
And I think, let me kind of set the tone a little without spoilers for people listening to this, because we really haven't. What the book is about is Ejok gets hired on sort of the last minute as a replacement for a dead crew member whose responsibilities were to, work the very basic gun systems of this fast and relatively small freighter, the Griselda. And their next assignment after he ships out with them is dictated because a news crew is going to this little planet that, you see sort of the realism that, unlike all the planets you visit in Star Trek where the whole planet's available, this is a very, very cold planet, and there's just a very small temperate zone around the equator that is just barely livable and usable for agriculture. And so they're going there, and
this leads to your Ken Fallon point where you said the bastard corporations, because that was because of a shoddy job terraforming the planet that some bastard corporation did. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but wanted to get that in.
Right, and well, on that point, you could always use the Chinese labor argument. Well, if they weren't working for a dollar a day, they wouldn't have any job at all. So, but this is a planet where it's very hard to get anything out of it. So they're, it's not like this hugely resourced and rich plant. Now, we do find out later that it's not all the fault of the atmosphere on the planet. That comes later. That these corporations are running at such minimal margins that they you could say they choose to treat their workers horribly. That's one thing I may have a little bit discussion with later, but I really don't want to get in that so much. But they're going to this planet because there's unrest And since, you know, because you have this, you know, weeks or months out of sync, getting news from one planet to another planet, they're getting theirs. Things are just about to hit the fan, and they'll be lucky to get out again. That comes fairly early, so that's not really much of a spoiler.
Yeah, and they have to basically stick around and wait for this news crew to leave their ship for the station, head down to the planet, and do their job, and then come back. They have to wait for them to make it back, or they won't get paid for their contract. And the owners of the ship, who are all officers and crew members on the ship as well, they're so indebted that if they lose this contract, they're going to miss a payment and they're going to lose their ship. So everything for everyone in this story is right on the ragged edge of what's possible and survivable as well. So that there's always that conflict throughout this whole story.
And we should tell people there are, as they say on TV, sexual situations talked about, if not described, in the book. So there, you know, it's probably an elder teen age limit on it.
Yeah, there wasn't so much sexual content in there, but there was some descriptions of sexual assaults. It's not the kind of risque type of thing. It's more like the brutality, more of a violence warning than a sexually explicit warning, I would say.
Well, you're right. And there's a whole lot of horrible violence actually described in pretty much detail.
Now, I'm curious as to what you guys thought of the main character, Ejok. I found him very relatable, but that also may be a weird kind of coincidence, and I can explain that after. I want to hear what you guys think about him, the main character, first.
I think he's relatable, but he doesn't make the same decisions I would make in the same situation. So, like, I understand why he makes his decisions, but like you were saying earlier, a lot of times I'm standing back just shaking my head going, it's not going to work out well for you, bro.
I have some thoughts that I think I'm going to choose to save until the spoiler section.
50, how about you?
Well, I think I've already said, you know, I think anybody who's ever worked in IT is going to recognize the IT guy in Ejok. I mean, he's not exactly athletic. I mean, he's a guy, you know, when he's running the ship's guns, you know, he's like maybe the best guy he could get, but he's no soldier.
Right, but, right. I mean, he's running the controllers, not with he's not running back and forth on the ship with the and manning hardware.
And you know, essentially, and this isn't much of a spoiler because it comes from the first couple chapters. He comes in and he's put in this hard position because the guy he's replacing, who got killed, was incredibly popular with the crew, and he has to go to him and say, look, this guy didn't know what he was doing. If you ever got in a firefight with this guy, you would be dead because, you know, he didn't have the gun set up right. And you've got all this, sort of junk equipment, everything not made to talk to each other. That's one of the first things he said. He said, it's kind of reference to a Raspberry Pi almost and the future equivalents. Like, look, I can go out, you know, and get this really cheap device and plug it in, and all your weapon systems will suddenly talk to each other, and they'll talk to my modern equipment that I've got on my PDA essentially, and my retinal implants, and everything will work so much better if you spend just this little bitty tiny amount of money.
Yeah, he the guy before him, I think. It wasn't that he bought shoddy hardware. He bought like high end stuff, but he bought, you know, different systems. It would be like if you tried to buy a Panasonic player and a Sony tuner for your stereo and a Samsung television, and now you've got 74 different remote controls, and there's no way to really tie them together.
And none of them have the same ins and outs.
Right, right. Everything needed a converter to plug into the one thing, into the other. And Ejok was the guy who knew how to make the, you know, the remote control out of a Raspberry Pi, basically, is what 50 was getting at. And he was like, yeah, none of this stuff, it all works, but you can't use it all at the same time because it's not coherent. It's not tied into one system. So he was making, like, fighting that, getting permission to make these things work when everybody thought his predecessor was God's gift to gunnery.
And he was telling them, look, you know, he test fired the guns on the way out of the first port. And they said, well, what was that? We've never seen him do that before. And he says, well, that's the way it's supposed to look. You know, the last guy didn't know what he was doing.
I mean, overall, as a character, I think that his mindset, Ejok would not at all be out of place in the community.
Yeah, right on. So the reason I asked, I found this guy incredibly relatable. And I think he did make many decisions that I would have made while I was if I were in his shoes. And I don't know if that is by design or by accident, because I remember early on when Lost in Bronx was beginning to write, or maybe he had written Motherlode, he asked me if I would be interested in voicing the character in the audiobook. And it didn't wind up happening. He, of course, he wound up reading it himself, but he told me at the time it's because he thought I'd be perfect for that role. He thought I was very similar to his character. And I don't know if he saw similarities and kept writing them that way or what, but I really related to this character in a way that was almost uncanny.
So for the rest of the evening, we're just going to call him Space Pokey.
I second this.
That's not where I was going with this, but I mean, like right down to the, you know, this dumpy guy who's got to run for his life and can't run, you know, like 100 yards, and he's winded and that kind of thing. Like right down to the very last detail, the way that the guy stuck to his word because he gave his word, like that kind of thing. A lot of people in the situation he was in, he had several opportunities throughout this book where he could have just bailed and no one would have blamed him for it. And things would have turned out okay, but it would have meant that he would have broken his word, even if just to himself, about the people that he cared about. And I find that I've done that to myself several times, and it's shot me in the foot. And this guy talks about how he shot himself in the foot several times throughout his career.
And several other places, too.
Yeah, right, by sticking with his principles, you know, and just, I don't know, I liked Ejok, and I was really rooting for him.
Well, there are a lot of places in the book, you know, they said, you know, they said, no, come back, you know, let's regroup, you know, don't go out being a hero. And he was like, I'm not being a hero, but I can go around here and I can, you know, I can do something. I can find out something, then I'll be back. And then, you know, things don't go exactly as planned.
I'm getting thirsty.
I was just about to say the same. I need to step away to grab my beverage. Give me 3 minutes or something. I'll be back.
Sure. 50, you must have a drink in your hand.
Surely I don't sound plowed already, but it's not the one I'm planning to introduce.
No, you don't sound plowed. I know you well enough to know that there's a 5150 to 50 shot that you have going in your hand.
The required podcasting fluid.
Yeah, fuel for podcasting. Well, I don't want this show to be like a recent show where as soon as it came out, I had to listen to the last 20 minutes to make sure I didn't get too far off the handle.
Well, you don't have to drink it all during the beverage review. Just take a sip and tell us what you think. You still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I didn't know that needed a response.
Well, what are you drinking tonight? What's your beverage?
Well, this is one that I have had before, and I was saving some for tonight than the last time I went by my liquor store. Fortunately, they had more, so I picked up another couple six-packs. This is Newcastle Werewolf. And Newcastle is, it's actually imported from Great Britain. And let's see, it's actually it's in Scotland. They don't claim to be a Scottish ale. It says it's in Edinburgh. So obviously it's Scottish. I'll read the description. What a better way to toast the fall than have a bottle of this formidable dual-character brew. At first, with mellow overtones of sweet berry fruit, a bite of bitterness suddenly cuts through, long, deep, and lingering. Brewed with rye malt, it is naturally blood-red in color, unlike the mythical wolf creature said to roam the bleak moorlands surrounding Newcastle. This is real, so consider yourself warned. So it pours, I'd say, a light amber color. I wouldn't call it dark red like they do. Pouring down the center of glass, so there's quite a bit of head on it. It's pretty light in alcohol content. It's only 5.7%. So it's not a complete lightweight beer, but it's not one of those hard hitters either. You definitely can taste the rye in the rye ale if you've had one before. Unlike most of the rye ales that I've ever had, this, like the description says, it starts off as slightly sweet, and then as it rolls against the back of your tongue, you can feel the hops in there. They're not abrasive hops. I wouldn't call this a really hoppy beer. It's certainly definitely not one of those my hops can beat up your hops kind of beers. But I had this last month, and I've been getting it just about every trip back since. This is definitely makes one of my top 10 lists, which is hard to get into. Top 10 of my favorite beers, definitely. It's not what I would call inexpensive. It's nearly $9 a six pack. Though I think the last time we discussed this, someone said on the coast that that's pretty cheap for a six pack.
Well, for craft brew, anyway.
It depends on the level of craft brew. Newcastle around here, it runs probably $7 to $8 for a six pack. But I've only ever seen Newcastle Brown Ale. I haven't seen or heard of Werewolf before, but you make it sound very interesting. What's the finish on that like? Because I know the brown ale kind of, it's way too sweet up front. Not way too sweet. It's very sweet up front. It's a little stale on the aftertaste. How about the Werewolf?
Well, if you don't like a sweet beer, I do. But if you don't like a sweet beer, this is probably still a little too sweet for you. I would say it's probably not that sweet on the start. I need to get some of that brown ale to compare with it, because I have had that before. It's probably not as sweet to start as the brown ale, but the hops certainly don't come through hard enough to wash it all away.
I see. Now, and I actually do like a sweet beer. I just find a lot of them take it one step too far, and I'd rather them be on the side of a little less sweet than a little too sweet, if you know what I mean. Like, once they've gone too far, it's like too much. I don't know. I do like a sweet beer. It's just some are too sweet.
Well, I guess I would say that when on the evaluation of my last sip, the hops do wash through, and they kind of wash the sweetness out, but then the aftertaste comes back, and it's still sweet.
Oh, okay, that's not bad. I'd rather have that than like a stale aftertaste. Cool. So that was Werewolf, Newcastle Werewolf?
Yes, that's correct.
Cool. And 50, if you wouldn't mind, did I give you the link for the Etherpad that we're using? I did, right? Yeah, it's there in the text chat. Would you mind just throwing up a couple of words about that in the beverage section?
Okay, I'll do that. I'm on my phone, so I'd rather not try to type on that during the show. But
oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, no, that's perfectly understandable. All right, Pegwall, what have you got a beverage tonight?
I have coffee.
Right on, man. What kind of coffee? Anything special?
Nope.
Isn't that what you had last time?
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, a returning favorite, Pegwall's coffee.
You should at least try to have different coffee every time.
I think last time was a French roast. This is a medium roast.
Ooh, highfalutin.
Might I recommend a nice Sumatra next time?
I will keep that in mind. I might even go crazy no Colombian.
X1101, you said you returned with something special?
Yeah, I was out over the weekend at one of the many local natural markets. I swear you can't swing a cat without hitting a dozen of them around here. But I got a Black Island Organic Oatmeal Stout. Got it because I hear so many good things about oatmeal stouts, but I've yet to have one. So here goes. It's got a chocolatey, malty nose to it. Almost no head, but that's because I poured it down the side of the glass to get more stout out of it. It's got a chocolatey, little bit of coffee, but mostly a chocolatey malt flavor to it. It's not overly carbonated, but it's not at all sudsy. It doesn't have quite the same thick texture that I'm used to from like a Guinness, but it is definitely a stout.
What was that?
I have no idea.
5150? I don't know. Something just happened. It sounded like you were squeaking a dog toy or something.
Or laughing at me.
Are you still with us, 50?
Killed by the squeak.
Yeah, something got to his connection, I'll bet. All right, X1101, where were you? You said it was not quite as... Oh, okay, he's answering a call. Not quite as thick as like a Guinness?
Yeah, the mouthfeel, it doesn't have that, you know, creamy, oily texture to it as much. I mean, it's definitely a stout, but it doesn't have that same creamy, oily texture to it. But otherwise, very, very good. It tastes a lot like a chocolate stout beverage. I guess I don't know why it's called an oatmeal stout. I don't know if it's made with oatmeal or it's supposed to taste like oatmeal, but it's good.
You use oatmeal in the brewing process at some point. And I think I've only had one or two oatmeal stouts, and I thought they were very thick and filling, like they'd stick to your ribs.
Well, it is Scottish.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And I'm looking for the alcohol by volume. Give me a moment.
Of course.
It's a measly 7%.
That's not bad, 7%. Can you taste all 7% of it?
Not at all.
Oh, that's dangerous then. So it sounds like overall you give it a thumbs up.
Yes.
Nice. Can you give us the name one more time?
Black Isle Organic Oatmeal Stout.
All right. Hey, now, where is that brewed? Is that from Maine or is it less local?
Considerably. It's imported from Scotland.
Oh, it's actually from Scotland. Okay, I'm thinking like Scottish style. All right, sorry about that.
No, it says product of Scotland, imported by Orchard Gate, Flushing, a certified organic.
Cool. Well, thanks for that, man. Taj, what do you got, buddy?
Since I ran in the door just to get here on time, the only thing I have to drink is my half-empty Nalgene bottle full of water that I brought from work.
Woohoo! Nalgene. Oh, that's our second repeat, too. You did that once before.
Yeah, I typically run a little late.
Right on. All right, and I am drinking something a little different this week. I've been trying to get into some sort of shape other than pear. And I've been going to the gym and doing a little bit of running for the past few weeks. And so tonight for my drink, because I have to go to the gym after we record this, I am drinking 6-Star Pro Nutrition Creatine x3 Elite Series Fruit Punch flavor. And it's not nearly as bad as it sounds. I got this special little shaker bottle at Walmart that's got like a stainless steel ball in it that has like an agitator, and you can pour it in this thing and shake it up, and it gets it to dissolve a little bit better and maybe puts a little foam in there. And I like to throw it in there with about, I don't know, almost twice as much water as it says to use, and then some ice cubes, and shake it up and drink it real cold. And it's actually pretty good. It's not too terrible.
Going to the gym after this? Wow.
Yeah, I got to go to the gym after this. A guy put together a workout routine for me, and I've been trying to stick with it as best I can. And it's a 6-day-a-week routine, and he'll be disappointed if I don't. He's put a lot of work into my routine for me, and it's kind of work, and I'm getting stronger. I haven't lost much weight. I lose about a pound a day, But I've dropped two notches off my belt in the past week or so, and I am able to get through most of the routines that he's given me, whereas my first week I couldn't finish like all the reps in a set, and then I couldn't finish all the sets, and one night I did about half of the exercises in the routine. I just could not go any further. I was hurting so bad, and my muscles just weren't responding or cooperating. But and then the first day I went out running, I mean, literally the first day I've ever tried running, I made it around a quarter mile track one time, and then I felt like I was going to die, and I had to walk for about the next half an hour. But one night I even made it around seven times. So, you know, a mile and three quarters, made around just jogging. I'm not flat out running yet. I'm not in that kind of shape, but it's working slowly and surely. It's coming along. And a couple of people say the creatine helps to build muscle. So maybe it's part of the reason why I'm not losing weight, because I'm just converting all my copious amounts of fat.
Oh, hush. And I've also been going back to the gym. I started in March, and I've been fairly faithful. I go 3 days a week and do about a half hour of cardio, and the difference is really amazing. The weeks I miss or don't go as much, just have no energy. But you know, when I went between work and dinner, and that's how I'm still awake. It's better than a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I was talking to Pegwall before the show, and I was telling him I even changed the way I drink my coffee. I stopped taking sugar in my coffee, and I'm now adding coconut oil to it, just because that's got some, I don't know, pretty unique characteristics to it. And I learned, you know what? Here's a fun fact for tonight's show. I'm trying to research everything that I'm doing, because there's so many people out there that just, there's so much quackery in the health food industry, and I'm trying to change my diet and eat a little healthier too. So I did some research, and the water that's in a coconut and the nutrients that are in it are so close to human plasma that you can take coconut water intravenously. And in some third world countries, they do exactly that. They put a couple of coconuts onto an IV tube, and they can rehydrate people with it directly. Is that astonishing or what?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, coconut water is like Mother Nature's Gatorade, like, except for it actually works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I read. It sounded exactly like that. Two or three different independent pages made it sound exactly like that. And maybe the fourth and the fifth one both said, this is Nature's Gatorade.
Yeah, it was one of those things many years ago when I was I would get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning and go do 2 hours of yoga before I went to school, because I was insane back then. That was the traditional post yoga drink, was coconut water, and it at that point it is very refreshing.
But just imagine, like, you're in some hospital, like close to death, and you open your eyes and there's a couple of coconuts with two tubes coming from them going into you. And your brain would go, surely I'm hallucinating.
I can imagine it, but I'm imagining it in black and white.
I would just assume I'm in a Monty Python skit.
To be honest, that would scare me a whole hell of a lot less than most of the things that would be hanging there going into my body.
That's not a bad point. Not now that I know it, anyway.
I've been rehydrated with saline solution, and I think I would have taken the coconut water if I'd had a choice.
Yeah, I've been there too. When I had to have it done, the cap on the IV, you know, they have the cap so you can add more tubes and all that. Well, one of them came off, so the saline was going in, but it was pushing blood out. That was a frightening experience to wake up to.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying.
Weird. So that's that for my beverage. Back to the review?
Back to the review.
All right, now, dear listener, here is where we will spoil the book, and we will spoil the hell out of it here. If you have not listened to the book yet, you probably want to stop the show now and go download it and listen to it. If you don't plan on listening to this particular book, you can listen to the rest of the show, but I don't know if any of us are going to like you after we find out you didn't want to listen to this book.
If you haven't heard this book and don't plan on listening to this book, please send me an email and tell me what's wrong with you.
Actually, better yet, if this is the kind of book that you don't like, if this is not for you, we actually do still like you. I was being facetious when I said that, but we probably need you to come on the next show and help us review our next audiobook, or maybe the one after. But yeah, we'd like to hear your opinion. All right, so I need to get into my first spoiler of the book. And that is my other criticism of the book. And I don't feel bad stating this publicly, because I did, in fact, email Lost in Bronx about this and had a discussion with him. And I sort of wished he had run this one by me before he wrote it, because it was way too late to do anything about it. But the Panther, which is Ejok's gun in this book, I thought was a bit too much like the weirding modules in the film version of Doom. I thought it the film version of Dune. I thought it was more of a plot device than an actual weapon. It was just a little too far-fetched and a little too convenient that it helped him get in and out of situations, and it felt like more of a plot point or a plot tool or whatever you call it. Sorry.
Can we not bring up that version of Dune?
No, I love that version of Dune. 50?
Actually, no. I thought about that gun the other day. Of course, I'm subscribed to like the same G+ groups as Flying Rich, and there was actually a gun like that. You know, where it's broken down in the case, and without, you know, it says, yeah, you can grab it and fire it without the barrel attached.
I mean, I guess at a certain point to get through the book, you have to have a gun that shoots plot bullets just to get out of situations. And I mean, I don't fault him for that. But, I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
I like plot bullets. It's not bad. And yes, I understand it. I don't, you know, have a big problem with it. Like, it was the only criticism of the plot that I could come up with at all. And I don't fault him for it, but, and yes, 50, I know that parts of the gun were not, impossible science fiction. The whole package, you know, the fact that it could shoot an RPG that's the size of a bullet. And again, okay, sure, we're in the future, this is possible now, but the fact that it was, you know, he had the only two seemingly in existence. Nobody else had technology this advanced until they got into super high-end energy weapons. It just, that was the only part that I thought was a little far-fetched.
Well, I could see it maybe up on the station, because the security police, you know, they had guns that were made not to blow holes in the side of the station, whereas his gun was made for planetary use. But you're right. Maybe that it seems to be so much more powerful than anything that the planet-side police had as a weapon.
Right, right. And we got space station bullets now. They're called frangible bullets. They're made out of sintered metal instead of a solid piece of metal. And they've been around for over 100 years. That's what they used to use in the carnival booths, was sintered bullets, so that it would, you know, go through the paper and the target, and it would probably go through you if it hit you, but it wouldn't go through that booth if it hit the back wall.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
I kind of feel like
we have that. We got to have that random time delay on the push to talk, but no. And I imagine air marshals probably carry something similar.
I kind of feel like we talked about like the Firefly similarities. I think inside Ejok there's a little Han Solo, and I imagine that if there was a situation like this, Han Solo would just like reach in a cabinet somewhere on the Millennium Falcon and pull out a badass gun and just be like, yeah, no, I just had this laying around.
Now Han would already have it under the table.
I have to agree that it shoots plot bullets. If you needed, he's like, oh, I need bullets that will hurt people but not shoot the space station. I have those. Oh, I need, like, super rocket launcher rounds. It does that, too. Oh, I need to shoot it from my bag. Yep, I can do that.
Well, any gun can do that. That's okay. I just...
It can shoot, like, half-assembled, though?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's possible, too. There are guns that break down and that are reconfigurable. It's completely possible. You know, and I said to him, like, this gun, the barrel can come off, but it can shoot without the barrel. And the only thing I said to him was, well, then why have a barrel? The only reason that you have a barrel on a gun at all, two reasons. One is for sighting, and the second is for velocity. The longer the barrel, the faster the bullet is going to come out the end of it. But if this thing shoots RPGs, you really don't care too much how fast the bullets come out. And this thing was supposed to have a sighting module built into it that interfaced with your eye implants, your retinal implants. So it kind of didn't need it for that either. So the barrel was a little unnecessary. And I just thought and it was weird. The first time I listened to it, I thought he broke it down and reassembled it a little too often. But the second time I listened to it, I didn't notice that. So I'm like at all. I didn't notice it at all. So I don't know. Maybe it was just me nitpicking too much, as I have a tendency to do.
It seems to me that it stayed broken down through a majority of the middle third to like middle half of the book.
And I don't know. I mean, he did make it clear that without the barrel, it was not very accurate. It was just randomly spraying bullets, and he never did shoot an RPG round without the barrel, I don't think. So, even an Uzi, you've got an option between the little stubby 3-inch barrel, and you can also screw on a 20-inch barrel to make it a carbine. So, you know, it's not that far-fetched. Like I said, I saw a gun just like that, that they were advertising, it was a suitcase gun, and they were advertising, where it's broke down and all the pieces in the suitcase. And I saw one earlier where it, actually did like the CIA thing, and you had a button in the suitcase handle to shoot the gun out through the side of the suitcase. But this one I saw recently wasn't like that. But it said, yeah, you can grab just the primary unit, slap a clip into it, and fire it.
So it was almost like a handgun that you could then add a barrel to make it a long gun?
Exactly. I think, and exactly like Lawson Bronx's scenario, this is not the optimal scenario to use this weapon. But if you're holding this briefcase and you come up against a fella drawing a pistol against you, you can flip open the briefcase and try to beat him to the draw.
Still a better option than being shot.
So what I think we're all trying to say here is, Pokey, your argument's invalid.
I can live with that.
Space Pokey shoots plot bullets.
At real Pokey.
Possibly.
At least at my one argument.
And I'm sorry, guys. I had another phone call, and then it was bleeding through on both sides.
Understood.
So I want to bring something up. When you finally figure out where the title comes from, holy crap.
Yeah, that was pretty horrifying. And I didn't even understand it until the second time I listened, because it was more horrifying than my imagination could handle.
Because I heard it, and I was like, there's no way that's what that just said. So I rewound it, and I listened to it 3 times to make sure that it was exactly what I thought it said. And yeah, I was just like, I'm not sure I would have the balls to name this book that.
And I think we should sort of leave that, for the future readers to find out. But
I was just going to say, and having listened to it twice, it was more horrifying the second time, because I think I got more detail the second time.
Yeah, this is for people who've already listened. The only one we're spoiling this for is Pegwall, and he deserves it. But yeah, I mean, the street candles were these people that they put in a barrel of oil and set on fire in the street and left them burning like human candles all night long to light their party when they won the war. It is pretty horrifying.
It's like calling the book Burning Rich People.
Yeah, essentially the people were the wick in the candles, and the whole, whole system was designed to burn them to death as slowly as possible.
And to be honest, the title Burning Rich People might be a little more enticing.
Yeah, and don't forget, they lit the candle with a cattle prod that didn't work on the first strike.
Now, my only problem with the book, I thought it got a little drawn out in the whole chapter leading up to that, describing the everything going on in the arena and the local comedian and all that. Now, a lot of that description, you know, and a lot of it has to do with Ejok's divided loyalty. You know, he understands why these people are rising up, because they've just been horribly, horribly disenfranchised and abused. But on the other hand, he can, you know, he just can't condone, you know, this treatment of the people, including, you know, the children of the people that these folks considered their enemies, some of whom he knew. He recognized on the TV monitors one of these people that was being burned to death as one of the kids had befriended him, or he had befriended in his flight through the city. And but I, you know, I'm sorry, Lost in Bronx, you know, but it's just, David, it just, that whole leading up to it, the whole description of the gala and all that, and that got just a little tedious for me.
It seemed like Ejok was, his point of view was, you know what, you have grievances, fight your fight, but you won. You don't need to be as vicious and brutal to them as they were to you after you've won.
And I think it goes a long way towards saying, you know, you before that, you build up a little, or at least I did, you build up some sympathy for the revolutionaries before you kind of know what's really going on. And then you see this and you're like, oh, my God, like these people are horrible. Like, I can't believe I had sympathy for them. And then you get all the way to the end and you realize that those people are getting played by the same people they thought they were disposing. Like, it's all this huge shell game of people just being bastards to each other.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And I, for that reason, I did not find this scene long and drawn out. I found it very detailed. He talked about the blacks and the show that they had put on the day before and hanging some of the elites that they found. And then this was a contrast of that. This was the show that the Blues put on, and it was a contrast to that. And he just, I thought he went into detail as to, you know, the setup of it, the people who were there, you know, the plebeians, how they dealt with it, how their leaders, their new leaders were now dealing with it, the reasons behind it all. I thought it was well laid out and well detailed. I did not find it to be tedious. I mean, as far as details go, you know, how he got in there was to pretend he was a worker. He picked up the end of a pipe and, boy, I'll be helping here. And it was one of the pipes that they tied these people to light them on fire. It was, and like his heart was just, you could feel that was just a soul crushing moment for him. And this whole thing was horrifying and it changed him emotionally and mentally. He kind of had an emotional or nervous breakdown here and had to recover from it. A lot of the book from that, he was a changed person, and that was only the first time he changed. He went through another change later in the book as well. But this was a real thing that he had to live through, and I thought it was very well done. So I had to disagree with you on that one.
That's one of the things that I was this whole scene kind of is the biggest example of what I was talking about earlier, of just kind of like mirroring what's going on in the world right now. Just absolutely recently, the last couple of weeks, you see these groups that their entire motive is to do the most horrifying things and get them in the biggest public display that they can to win influence and power, I guess, is the way to, or to at least push their viewpoint. And it's just that's really close to home. And getting to see it as close as Ejok is to it is like ridiculously powerful and grotesque. And I think it goes a long way towards making the end of the book make a little more sense.
Yeah, and while I was gone, did you guys explain the difference between the two rebel groups, the blacks and the greens, where one group is secular and the other group is non-secular, and that, you know, they kind of brought in a whole religion in. As well as their, you know, as their revolutionary principles? Because if you hadn't explained that, you know, a few minutes ago, Pokey was talking about how the blacks were hanging people, and we should say that that's the color of their hats and their armbands, not a racial reference. So I want to make sure people listening to this did not hear that and construe it the wrong way.
Yeah, thanks for that. No, we didn't really talk about it, but then it's not really it's not really any more detailed in the book than what you just said either. It's brought up.
I just wanted to make that clear, because I knew that reference by you out of context would get letters.
That's a good point. That probably would not have come across correctly if someone hadn't listened to it.
Well, that's true. You're only supposed to be listening to this if you have read the book, so even so.
Maybe Pegwall thought I was a horrible person for just a minute there. Clearly, Pegwall is AFK, because normally he would have said, no, it's been way more than a minute. You had brought up 50. You had alluded earlier to a character. I think you were talking about, is it Takiar? I believe it's Takiar, the butler. Is that who you were talking about before the spoilers?
Yes, exactly. And I don't want to go too far off the rails, but I do want to talk about the only other weak point I saw in the book was Dell dies because Ejok does not respond fast enough, like he's stunned. And, you know, Ejok earlier in the book, when he took his revenge against Takiar, he had warned him on the radio while, you know, he and the elites were, Ejok was escaping with the elites, it was after that, but he knew Takiar, suspected Takiar was a rebel, high rebel leader, and he says, you know, he told Takiar, if you hurt these kids, the children of the elites that he had met and befriended, I don't know how I'll do it, but I will come find you and I will kill you. And that's exactly what he does later in the book automatic weapon in the bag that you have such problems with, Pokey, that, you know, he saw Takiar standing there, you know, with a bunch of his uniformed buddies, and he just walked straight up to him and blew him away. And the only way he got away was that the other rebels standing around were just so constantly drunk on grain alcohol all the time, when bullets came flying, they had no idea where they were coming from. So everybody else just ducked for cover. You know, he took out the only really sort of more professional soldiers there in the whole place. So I don't know what to suggest to Lost in Bronx. If he ever had to rewrite this, you know, for Syndicate, you know, some other thing, if there was a way to make it, you know, so it's just not Ejok is just standing there and doesn't react when Del is killed. Maybe that does make it poignant because it's completely Ejok's fault, but it's, you know, it doesn't seem to fit with what he had been doing earlier.
But that happens before he kills Takiar.
Okay. I guess you're right. That was after they got back.
I would say that when Del dies, he is completely flat-footed, because at that point, he's not successfully engaged in close-quarters violence. He's a gunner. He deals with, you know, objects in space. It's not until then that he starts to apply those same tacks to person-to-person close-quarters combat.
Well, I guess you're right, because while he had not he's shown reluctance, but, you know, when he had no other way out of the situation, he hadn't shown any hesitation using the guns and shooting at people, at least, earlier in the book. I guess that probably was the first face-to-face combat that he had been in.
At the very least, it's the first time when Del dies, it's the first time he executes any, you know, personal maneuvers with any kind of finesse. All the instances before that were him blundering through to survive. It's not until when Del dies that he somehow makes the connection of him being a gunner for the ship. He can apply those same tactics in personal combat.
Well, he he came very close to applying them very early on when he landed at the space station. But before he could take action, there was a game changer and you know, the wall blew apart on him. But I think that when he shot Tachyar, that was the first time he actually shot at a person. The first time he used that gun, he was shooting at a ship and trying to blow that up. And yes, he did kill people, but not directly. So I can see his mind getting over the damage of it.
Well, he also shoots a soldier when he's with the kids fleeing.
Does he shoot a soldier? I remember he shot at the ground and he blew up a steam pipe and it stopped a crowd. I don't remember him shooting a soldier.
Okay, that might have been it.
You could be right. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying I don't remember it.
Well, either way, there was gunplay there, him discharging the weapon to, you know, protect himself. But I guess my point is he was blundering his way through that. With the scene with Takir is the first time he deliberately approaches that the way he deliberately approaches his ship-to-ship combat scenarios.
Yeah, and that scene with Tachyar, I have to say, was very well done. It was so subtle. I did not even catch it the first time around. I didn't know who he shot. It didn't make sense to me. The second time I listened to the book, I caught on. I was like, oh, how did I miss that the first time? And how did I not rewind it to figure that out? It was so pivotal. Because I think Ejok suffers three very serious emotional blows in this book, which lead to him being such a basket case at the end and needing so much treatment. And the first, I mean, maybe even four, if you count the first day that he was there, just all the physical things he went through, all the, you know, horrors that he saw, people being beat to death, you know, all those things affected him, I'm sure. But then the scene in the street where they burned the people had to have had an effect on, it did have an effect on him. And the second was when Del died, and that had a further effect on him. And he assumed personal blame for that. And then that third scene where he became a murderer. There's no two ways about it. He murdered Tachyar. And I'm not saying Tachyar didn't deserve it. He was obviously very bad. But this was a case of Ejok giving his word, you know, saying, if you hurt those kids, I will come find you and I will get you. Tachyar hurting the kids and Ejok living up to his word, even though it made him a murderer. And that was the kind of duty that I found unique in Ejok that I just thought was so fantastic. And I can see those things having serious mental consequences on a person.
And I almost, when you're talking about duty, I almost think that it's at least in part him projecting some of that duty of what being made honorary family member. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the word they use for it, but the honorary family member of that household. Part of that is, you know, continuing to protect them. And I don't know, maybe he saw some implied duty there and chose to act on it. In addition to, you know, I said, don't do that. You did that. And, you know, I told you what was going to happen. And so here it is.
I think the book does a really good job of never actually calling out and saying that he's struggling with this and like his slow kind of creep towards doing what he does. But it just shows it, like you just kind of understand that like he is getting to the point where things are so desperate that he's willing to do things he was never able to do before. And part of that is his character. I agree with Pokey. Part of it is, look, I already told you this was going to happen, and here it is. But another thing is I think he's just slowly almost devolving into something that he doesn't really like. And I think at the end of the book, that makes a lot of sense why he just never revisits that part of his life ever again.
Yeah, it made me feel that he was very consistent. You know what I mean? It helped layer that on there. And while we've been talking here, we've been joined by another person who'd like to participate. Someone I don't believe I've met before, Tojet. Hey, Tojet, is your audio working? Are you here to talk?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. So you listened to Street Candles?
Yeah, I saw you'd posted it a while back and got the feed from it. And interesting series.
Yeah, that's what we've all been saying. We're into the spoiler part of the review at this point, the third segment of our show. So anything you'd like to say, feel free to say it.
So I did have a theory I wanted to float by the rest of you guys and see what you thought. After having listened to Motherlode and then Street Candles, Ejok is several times put in a situation where special operatives kind of happen around him and he responds very well to it. And several times it's implied that he may be an operative of some kind himself. And based on the fact that the book is being told all from first person memory, I'm almost wondering if he might be eventually, or he might be deep cover or something. Because he seems to make, I'll call them either lucky or unlucky, guesses and choices at pivotal moments. And that could just be he's got the magic gun that shoots plot bullets again.
I see what you're going with. I see what you're getting at there. But I think his guesses are better than luck. I think he's got, and this is where he and I depart a little in our characters, he's got a very good analytical mind. And he walks you through his decisions, and this is another one of the things where I got more out of it the second time than the first, is I felt like he walked me through those decisions, and I understood what he was saying and what was going on. Whereas the first time through the book, there were probably four or five times where he made, from my point of view, he turned two pages at once, and I just didn't follow and just said, okay, well, that's fine. I'll go with it. It wasn't too jarring or disturbing. But the second time through, I kind of picked up on the subtler details. So, I mean, maybe he's an operative, but I think he's just very analytical.
Well, yes, that's kind of what I... Go ahead, 50.
I think he's just very good at what he does. He obviously puts in the extra effort to what he does. I mean, he's always scouring the net to find some scenario that he hasn't thought of, and to take what he can get from it. Most of us, we watch cat videos on YouTube in our free time. We don't come home from our work and go out there and I know not everybody here is in IT, not everybody listening is in IT, but I don't come home from work and always go looking for, okay, let's go find some networking situation that I've never dealt with before and learn how to handle it ahead of time. So he's obviously very dedicated. You know, this is his vocation. This is what he wants to do. But I think a lot of it on this whole thing, Alan Smalls, you know, keeps insisting, well, you can't be just a civilian. You've got to be an operative. It's just Alan Smalls' own hubris that, you know, oh, no, I can't be beaten by some amateur.
Yeah, but the end there when he's recovering in the hospital and he gets the visit from the gunner from the military ship asking him how he managed to defeat such an advanced ship, he goes through and he's basically saying, well, I listened to enough crackpot theories and I followed one of them and it actually worked.
Yeah, but that's what X1101 meant, I think, when he said that since it's told in the first person, he could be lying to us at that point. If he were an agent, that's he would lie to us at that point. But, I'm not sure. X1101, what were you going to say to when you and 50 were colliding there?
I guess what I was saying was you were making the point that he's, you know, an analytical mind and he puts things together right at pivotal moments or puts them together beforehand and plays them close until pivotal moments. What I'm saying is because this sounds like it is told from the first person memory, it could be that he becomes an agent or is a deep cover agent or something, and this is part of his history or backstory as to how he became that, you know, all of these skills developing, and then he becomes that. But at the same time, I also question that if his personality would allow him to, because there's a dishonesty, a duplicity in that that I'm not sure he could stomach.
That's a good point. I think I agree with that more so than the other.
I think especially after meeting some of the people he met in this book, I think he would find it very unsavory to be like them.
Right. And I think the whole point of Vijak, he's only an accidental hero. He, you know, he's not, you know, he does have this code that pushes him once he gets in these situations, you know, to not back down and not give up. But he, you know, he's not out there glory seeking. You know, he's just out for this nice little ride where he never has to use his guns, hopefully.
But he is a gunner. And, you know, I would assume that if you choose the profession of gunnery, you have to go into that with your eyes open, knowing that, you know, it's my job to shoot and be shot at. I hope I never have to do my job, but it is my job to shoot and be shot at. So you have to be willing to accept that, too, going into that kind of a career.
No, no, no. Is Jock never having fight war up close? He's only from far away. He's too different.
Yeah.
that was very well done, Pokey. Very well done.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of it was with him choosing a gunner, he was intending to shoot at range, not actually see the person he's shooting at, but sort of deal with them abstractly. And the whole story, he's having to deal with everything first person, which is completely outside of his normal realm of operations. But even through all that, he's trying to be the professional, doing his job the best he can going through there.
That completely wonderful, Pokey, and I'm completely in favor on the next Ejok story. You voicing whatever Imperial Space character David decides to come up with.
No. It's as I said to him when he first. Maybe 2 years ago now. Or longer, possibly, when he asked if I'd be interested, I said I would gladly ride his coattails, and that's it. I would never presume to take it once it's been done. He's doing this the way it's intended to be.
I think after last month's, fake Ken Fallon, and this year, or this time's fake Ben Rogerston, I think you have a career, man. You just do bad impressions of people. That'd be awesome.
Thanks, man. Yeah, Ben Rogerston might have been my favorite character in the whole book. I, at one point, before Ejok went planet side, I thought Ben Rogerston was a goner. I thought for sure he was going to die in the next chapter, and I was so upset. And then he didn't, and I was so happy.
Did anybody else, this is probably just my messed up mind, did anybody else picture him as a dwarf the entire time? Every time he came on, I imagined him being like 3 foot tall.
No.
No. No. Has anyone seen Rise of the Guardians? It's a animated movie about these, like, Santa and stuff, and I kind of pictured Ben Rogerston as the Santa from that movie.
No, I thought he must have looked like my Greek barber, who sadly passed away a couple months ago, but he's just, I mean, a little short, but not short. No, not dwarf, or a little person, I think is what 50 said we were supposed to call him. But just kind of a stout, roundish old man, and very likable with a kind face. And I really liked Ben Rogerston a lot.
No, I'm legit. Like 3 foot tall, like braided beard and an axe. Like, that's literally what I imagine.
You're a dope.
No, I imagine him all the way through as, you know, this really massive guy, you know, maybe shorter than each other, you know, maybe a tick below average height or something, but just, you know, this huge presence.
Nice.
Very much a large presence. And yeah, I'll throw that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, link in the show notes. I hear Ken saying it. Any other characters stick out to any of you guys?
Well, I had an image of Ejok through the whole thing of being this like skinny guy just being thrown through the whole thing. And at the end, when he's recovering, and they talk about the fact that he lost so much weight, so through a strange method of reconstruction, that made me think that maybe he was a bit chubby going through the whole thing, and then when they were reconstructing at the end, they made him thin.
Ejok is definitely a guy that spends a lot of time in a chair.
Oh yeah, he made mention of that. He spent a lot of time in the chair, not a lot of time in the gym, or none at the gym, and eating lousy space crap food.
I like this guy.
Oh yeah.
He strangely sounds familiar.
Somehow.
You might have liked it more if you'd have listened to the book.
Shots fired.
Incoming! Pegwell, use your lantern guns!
Well, my second favorite was the armless jazz guy, who I should remember the name of.
It's the blues, not jazz. You gotta be particular. It's the blues.
Yeah, he was a very cool character. He was fantastic. And I looked up Tar Heel Lincoln, and there are hundreds of results, but it wasn't a real singer. It was kind of sad.
Yeah, if you can find anything Creative Commons as outro music or something that's passed in the public domain, I don't know if it's been quite long enough.
I kind of imagine, I don't know how many people in here are like blues heads, but it reminded me of, like, in my head, I was hearing like Robert Johnson or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Or what's the other guy's name? Gatemouth. No, I don't remember his name, but real old tinny sounding recordings.
I tend to like my blues played about double speed and through a nice aggressive amplifier. Usually sounds like metal at that point.
I like blues, just not all day. Just little, you know, couple songs and then maybe on to something else.
Yeah, I like the blues best after a divorce. Maybe a year or two's worth.
That's deep, man. That's deep.
Hey, it's how I survived.
I thought the character was really cool, though, and I can't remember his name. But I constantly was like, are we ever going to find out what this guy did to where he's totally like, no, I'm cool. I live in squalor, and I have no arms or no hands. But you know, this is way better than actually going back to real space and trying to get fixed.
Because at least they're not dead.
Right. Apparently he was some sort of mob informant.
I liked him. I liked about him that he reminded me of, you know, one of these dudes who surfs 3 or 4 IRC channels at the same time and just makes it his business to pay attention and to help when he can be helpful and kind of gets along. I mean, because he obviously couldn't do anything for anyone that didn't involve communication and, you know, sniffing out some data. So it really, this guy had a real IRC feeling to me.
He also is a character that shoots his own plot bullets every once in a while. There's a couple times that Ejak could get in a jam. He's like, oh, wait a minute, let me call my buddy. And then it just magically gets fixed.
Don't you have an IRC buddy? That's exactly how it works.
Yeah, I know who he is now. This is the Space Jay Lindsay.
Actually, he could be. Kind of cross between Jay Lindsay and Klaatu, maybe.
Most of my IRC buddies are right here.
I was going to say earlier I forget who was even saying it, but they were saying that Ejok's the kind of guy who goes home from work and then works on more work. And it reminds me of someone who would play NetHack just to learn how Vi works.
Hey, I represent that remark.
Attaboy.
You know, I use Vim all day just so I can figure out how you play NetHack.
Nice one.
I play NetHack and then use Emacs. Am I doing it wrong?
Yes.
This explains why I never got more than 30 levels down in NetHack.
I think we should continue the game of taking people from Outcast Planet and just casting them in the book. I think that would be fun.
Well, then Double N Dan, it has to be Syndra.
Seconded.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no monkey with a gun, so NY Bill is out.
Well, maybe he was the other part of Ejok's personality. You know, I do want to say, what's Takiar? He, out of all the people in the book, I think he was the one character who I couldn't quite come to grips with, because he changed so much. And I get that when he was in the service I forget the guy's name now, the elite guy. Yeah, I get that when he was in his service, it was a put on. I understand that. But I couldn't come to grips with him being so, such a lunatic when he was screaming at Ejok over the phone, communicator, whatever you want to call it. He seemed to like flip his lid at that point, you know?
Well, it does seem a little strange to me, because this is a guy who was, apparently butlers are now bred and trained in academies. So, you know, it seems a little incongruous that somebody who has been trained from early life that, you know, you're a servant for the rich, and that, you know, that's your purpose in life. I mean, it's like Alfred going to work for the Joker. that struck me as, you know, I had a little trouble believing that too.
Everybody take a drink. There's a Batman reference for the night.
Well, there had to be one.
Now we have to, we had Star Wars. Now we have to get Star Trek. And, well, we had a Dune reference. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, everybody Pegwall's age is going to be saying, what's Dune?
Well, you can tell there was no Star Trek in this story because otherwise they would have just beamed him back up and Ejok wouldn't have had the whole episode on the surface.
Well, either I am uncategoristic for my age or Pegwall's even younger than I am because I read Dune in high school.
And Pegwall will be mad at me because I know he's read Dune. I haven't. I've just watched the movies.
I've never read it.
I read all of them, and I mean all of them. And there's only three you should ever really read.
Well, which three do you think that is?
The first three. Don't read the three after, and don't read anything that his son had anything to do with.
They weren't awful.
They weren't the same.
No, not at all.
It went from being Frank Herbert to being like a young adult novel, almost. I don't know. It was just like the tone was completely different.
Yeah, my only real literary accomplishments is reading the entire Dark Tower series and all of the Lord of the Rings.
Well, the Dark Tower is quite a hike.
If you haven't also read The Silmarillion, I don't think you can call Lord of the Rings a literary accomplishment.
I'll scratch that one off my list then.
Now, here's where I'm going to get kicked off the show, because I read most of Dune. I read, I'd say, probably 4/5 of the way through it, and I had to put it down. I was too frustrated. It wasn't as much. It wasn't enough like the movie that I love so much.
And see, I couldn't watch the 1984 version of the movie because it wasn't enough like the book that I love so much.
I love them both. Like, just, they exist in different universes. I'm totally cool with both being there.
Yeah, they're totally different stories. You're the only other person I've ever met liked that movie besides me and my brother. We just sit down and watch that movie anytime. But yes, it's a different story. It's not the same story.
It's a David Lynch.
Have you guys seen?
It's a David Lynch movie with some characters from a book I like.
Have you guys seen the 2000 or 2005 sci-fi miniseries of the movie as well?
We don't talk about that one.
Oh, I completely disagree. I think that it is much closer to the book, and I loved it.
2005?
It might have been 2000. I think it was 2000. It had to have been, because I bought it while I was still in high school.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got the DVDs of it. I watched it when it was on TV, and I bought the DVDs, like a 6-part miniseries, right? Frank Herbert's Dune? I did like that.
Do we also not talk about the latest Star Trek movies?
Ugh.
Don't bring that up.
He still found ways to kill guys in red shirts.
Because I'm not going to lie, I don't like Star Trek, but I like those.
Well, that says it all, doesn't it?
I think that was the point.
And that's why I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I hate those movies.
And I'm looking at the entire set of Star Trek and Star Wars sitting on my DVD shelf at the moment.
And I have to split the difference. I am a Star Trek fan, and I still like those, because maybe we can get Star Trek restarted again, because it's been too long without good Star Trek.
It will never be the same again.
Oh, it'll never be the same, but it could be new, and it's still okay.
I don't know. Disney got a hold of Star Wars.
Yeah, don't remind me.
I mean, how do you go on? Do you go on, you know, 100 years past Next Generation? And, you know, because unless they say that the timeline heals itself or something like that, you can't base anything after that on anything that happened in Next Generation because it never happened.
Unless they come out of the hollow room again, and coming out of the hollow room was a hologram.
No. On the original series, they did the Next Generation. So on the new series, they're going to do the alternate generation.
Actually, I'm such a big dork that I know this. Even though that, like, God, I'm such a nerd. Even though that they, like, went back in time and rebooted the timeline, according to, like, the Star Trek, I guess if you can call it canon, it's ridiculous anyways, the prime timeline actually kept going. So like the books and stuff that are coming out kept going after the destruction. Well, I don't know if it's after the destruction of Romulus, but like after Next Gen, they kept going on.
Well, what worries me about the new Star Wars movie is that you know, they said only the 6 movies are canon, and I mean there's been no series like Star Wars where the games and the books and, you know, when the cartoons have all been incorporated into canon, you know, so as far as, you know, and it's just laziness of the producers. Oh, we're just going to watch the six movies, and then, you know, we're free to contradict the entire rest of the universe. So, you know, everything's come out with Han and Leia and their kids and the books and all that. Oh no, that's, you know, we don't have to pay any attention to that.
Oh, it's not even good laziness, because good laziness would be to pick somewhere in the, you know, several thousand years of extended universe and make them into movies. Somebody already wrote the story.
I've already gotten over the fact that anybody making a movie of something I like is making a movie for me. I'm past that magic target demographic where they want, and they're just making movies to make money, and they're not interested in what I love. And so for Star Wars, I have 30 years worth of books and comics to keep me happy. And if I don't like the new movies, so be it. I didn't like the prequels. I pretty much ignored them.
What I'm worried about is Ben Affleck as Batman.
Nah, he's going to kill that.
Ben Affleck kills every movie he's ever been in. The only movie to ever survive Ben Affleck in one piece, and just barely survived at that, was Dogma.
I was hoping you were going to say Dogma.
I just because of all the like crap that's gone on with that and everything, I'm just like secretly like that movie's going to be awesome. Like, because I have no expectation of it being anything other than a giant suckfest. It's going to come out and be awesome. It just has to.
What about Ben Affleck and Mallrats?
I didn't dig Mallrats a whole lot. He was the right guy for that role, though. You're right.
Yeah, I think they're overreaching unless they want to actually rename this movie Justice League. They've come out with too many DC characters. That's why you can't do a Justice League movie, because they'd all be on screen for 10 minutes. Though I guess they do it with X-Men, but look at X-Men. They, you know, they go with the, they only do the top seven or eight, and, you know, you have this whole pantheon of X-Men, and, you know, people always complain about there are several important X-Men that have never been in a movie. You know, we had the Avengers, and the Avengers were only four of them. I'm not that up on the latest Marvel stuff, but I thought there were more than four people in the Avengers in the comic book. I guess more than six, whatever. I thought there was more than that. But you split it too many ways and nobody has any kind of screen time. And it just seems like on this Superman versus Batman, the last few months, every month there's been a new DC character added.
Well, DC's already said that, like, that's why they changed the title on Batman versus, well, I'm sorry, Batman v Superman, because they're not versus each other, at least that's what the director says. And they gave it the subtitle Dawn of Justice, is because the next movie after that is Justice League. Like, they're just setting up a Justice League movie because they're trying to catch up with Marvel, and they're not doing a very good job.
So maybe all of this inconsistency in canon and poor storytelling and shortcutting and lack of quality, maybe that's what motivated Lost in Bronx to write such a complete and well thought out story that is true to itself all the way through.
Bringing it back, I like it.
Pokey is the master of redirecting back to on topic.
Well, I gotta edit this thing and I still have to go to the gym tonight.
Well, are we at the point where we can talk about the whole denouement of the story? Because, you know, I was kind of just thrown for a loop. I, you know, when it came back.
Hey, 50, you just died. I don't know what just happened. You started kind of blinking in and out, and now your lips are even just flashing at us, and there's no sound coming through. I thought I heard you ask if we can talk about denouement, and that's fine. We can talk about that if someone tells me what that word means.
Lol.
Yeah, I'm getting a whole bunch of notifications all at once. That may be part of it, but it's just how he ended the story. You know, like the last two chapters, we were having this rollicking space battle, and Ejok had just done the coup de grace on the, that's the right way to pronounce that. Anyway, on Alan Smalls, and we still haven't seen how that was going to be resolved. And suddenly, we cut to 3 months later, Ejok in a hospital bed.
Yeah, I thought it was the only way you could wrap that up. I mean, he was in a severe space battle. I'm still not sure how he survived it. The ship was at zero atmosphere, and they were all in their spacesuits, which was something I've never heard in any other sci-fi. I thought that was brilliant that you know, you should draw the atmosphere out of here and everybody should be in spacesuits in case there's a hull breach. That was brilliant. I've never heard that done before, but that's beside the point. So, like, he took a tremendous physical damage and he didn't die in that spacesuit in the time that it took, you know, a hospital ship to reach them. And I don't know exactly how that happened, and it wasn't explained, but explaining his long, long recovery and tremendous amount of debriefing, I felt like was the only way you could close the story. But I like that he took it that one extra chapter to explain his mental condition, and he's emotionally a broken man, and why he can't return to the ship, and why he can't get out of his bed. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I really liked it because I think you, as a reader, you kind of want him to do one thing, but then I don't know about anybody else. Me as a person, I completely understand, like, everything he does at the end of the book. Like, I get that. I've been in that situation where you've had a really, really, really meaningful experience with a group of people and you just have to walk away and you can't go back. It's over. Like, you just can't be around those people. You can't, anything you do is just going to bring it back in a negative way. So you just kind of have to walk away, which is not what you as a reader, I think, want. I think you to make it, you know, the best fairy tale ending, he joins the crew of the Griselda as an owner and goes on and does, you know, space piratey things or whatever. But I think it was more true to him as a person to end it the way it did.
Well, I agree. I was kind of rooting for Ejok to go with Griselda, but that's not the story of Ejok. Ejok is this loner. Ejok is the outsider in every situation. It would not, you know, this series is not the story of Griselda. It's a story. It's a story, continuing adventures of Ejok. And having set the precedence in the first book, I mean, I agree, that's the only way it could end. For Ejok to go off on his own to a new ship and to new people that he, you know, he really never completely connects with. They're his shipmates, but, you know, they're just his co-workers. They never become his family. He, you know, the character is just this loner type guy, you know. And like I said, I understood that at the end of the book. I, you know, at the end, I said, man, this is great. This is brilliant. But, you know, when he first, you know, when Dave first did it, it was just so jarring. It's like, what? You know, I've never seen that before in science fiction. You just jump out of a battle without exactly knowing how it ended, and it's 3 months later. You know, and I agree with the fact that they fight in vacuum. I mean, they had just so much realism in this book. I mean, you know, nothing else in this book could make it more plain. This is not the Star Trek, Star Wars universe where, you know, that combat is this clean and high tech and no big deal thing that we've become to think it is. In science fiction stories, it's, you know, it's this incredibly inconvenient and dangerous damn thing that you don't want to be involved in. Did that come through? Did I lose you guys?
I'm still here.
Yeah, it came through. I was trying to let someone else have a turn talking, and I was typing up my beverage review.
Well, I thought it was interesting at the end there where he cleaned it up, and with Ejok having to go through all the rehabilitation, where they basically did a genetic remaking of him. They said they weren't sure about his memories and all. I mean, for the author, if he continues the story, he can change whatever he wants about the character and just tie it all into the reconstruction while still having it be the same person.
More magic plot bullets.
Well, I mean, the only reason that he got the treatment he did, I mean, I think if it was any other character in any other book, they just would have let him die because he's not that important. But he had something they wanted, like he had information. And so they were going to keep him alive long enough to get it. So I wouldn't put it past him to do some shady stuff with him while he's in a incapacitated state, especially when they gave him those drugs. They could have probably sent him out on some missions or something crazy.
Well, they wanted to know how he beat their shiny missile that was incredibly unbeatable.
No, they didn't ask him about that. That was just an enlisted guy. He was just a crew member that wanted to know. They wanted to know everything else, the whole political situation and legal situation behind it. It was weird, but not uncommon, that this bureaucracy didn't even think to ask him how he defeated this, what they call Star Shark, I think.
Or that's what they wanted him to think. I would think that with Ejok's character, he would be much more likely to tell the truth about how he beat it to an unassuming fellow gunner than more being bludgeoned over the head by suits, asking, well, how did you do that crazy thing that no one should be able to do?
Yeah, I totally assumed that guy was a plant that they'd send in to get that information.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like we're operating.
Did they ever say that they didn't ask him about that? Because it seems like they were very detailed in everything else that they asked him. You know, if one of us went into essentially dropped ourselves into another country and shot a bunch of people, you know, because that was the only way to get out, and got turned back over to our government, you'd be in some dark hole somewhere still.
Well, he did say a couple of times during the recovery that they kept asking him questions, and he started becoming uncooperative and fighting with them, and so maybe they were trying to ask him and never could get down that train of questioning.
That's kind of what I meant, that, you know, he has a contrary streak a mile wide, and so maybe they figured out that the best way to get information out of him was professional curiosity, you know, playing to his ego, where I'm sure he couldn't help but talk about how to ply his trade.
He doesn't trust us. Send in the kid from Wisconsin.
But doesn't it seem strange that an enlisted guy was able to get into a maximum security area to question him about something like that with nobody interrupting him?
No.
Even when Ejok started yelling at him at the one point?
Yeah, maybe then, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, if you work at a place, you know how to get around the place.
Oh, speaking of which, guys, not to take this sideways, when I send you my notes, Pokey, I'll send you a link. I just found this today. You know, and for me, the last review we did was Down and Out in Magic Kingdom. But I just found a link on YouTube. And I'll, once the show comes out, I'll put it in the comments too. I mentioned when we did the review on Down and Out that I'd been watching Disney ride videos because, you know, I developed a certain fascination, and, you know, there's Disney Secrets videos and all that, but there's one on there that actually shows, there's some will actually show the tunnels below Disneyland, and I haven't looked. You know, there's like service tunnels all over, and people got in there and filled them, even though they can get, you know, arrested for doing so. But there's a couple kids, and they start out going to the, quote, secret pet cemetery, which isn't very secret around the Haunted Mansion, but then they... I don't know if one or both of them was dressed in butler's uniforms like cast members. So one of them must have been working for Disney, and he's probably unemployed now, if anybody ever saw this video. But they actually go, you know, around where the pet cemetery is, there's the cast interest entrance, which isn't locked. And they go up in the facade of the Haunted Mansion. And, I did a little poke around there, and what's actually in the mansion part of the Haunted Mansion, because the ride, the whole thing from when you get in the cars and you go around and all that, that's actually this huge complex that, you know, when you're at least in Disneyland, you know, when you're in the stretching room, you're actually going down a level and you're going when you go through, you take the walking part of the ride towards the doom buggies, you're crossing under a man-made river and coming out the other side, and there's like this, huge factory, well, not factory size, but this big industrial building on the other side where the actual ride takes place. And then you come back around and you get out and you exit through the facade. The place actually looks like the Haunted Mansion. But, I did a little look. So, what's in the upper stories of the Haunted Mansion? And, you have the two stretching rooms, the big huge elevators that go down. And really, there's not room for much else because there's that final part in the stretching where you look up and the guy is hanging from the ceiling, which is a story or two above you. So, these elevator parts actually extend way up into the facades. There's not much room on those upper two floors for anything else. But to get back to this video, these kids are going in. Apparently, the first room after they get in there is a cast leisure area because you see it's very poorly shot, but you see a bunch of people standing around drinking pop or something, and then they go down a hallway and up a stair, and most of it is not set up like the Haunted Mansion. There's one door to go through. It's like a Haunted Mansion door, but but you can tell they're in places where they got to be careful how loud they speak, because they're in places where they could be seen by people going into the rooms and the foyer of the Haunted Mansion and going out into the into the stretching rooms. And interesting piece of trivia I found out the last few weeks that the stretching room in the Disney World, it's all on one level, so you're not actually descending. The top part of the room actually raises above you. So there's a difference there. But I found that pretty interesting because I haven't seen anything else that actually shows pictures from behind the scenes. And well, there's behind the scenes tours, but not down the hallways and normally public inaccessible areas of the building. So, man, I've been talking 5 minutes about this. I need to shut up. So continue with the book review.
Where were we?
We were talking about the denouement and Ejok and the abrupt transition from the end of the battle to his recovery.
And even after all the rehabilitation and the money he gets, he still wants to go out and be a gunner.
Right, he's in a position where he could just get a room and stay there the rest of his life.
Well, I think he kind of is a stand-in for kind of the Unix philosophy. He has one thing and he does it really well, and I don't think he knows what to do besides that. He's a natural at being a gunner, so that's just he can't think of any other way to be than that way.
He's either a gunner or he's eating greasy diner food.
Yeah, he just likes all the space travel.
Well, I mean, and I can't really say that I would be any different. I'm sure that if I played the lottery and if I won the lottery and didn't require going to work for my paycheck, I would find somewhere I liked to work and continue doing what I'm doing because somehow I like being in IT.
Well, I mean, this is why rock stars and movie stars die broke, because... I'm not saying they're easy jobs. I mean, when they're on, it's like, 9-10 hours a day for rock stars on the bus or whatever, going from one place and then 3 hours of just killing yourself on stage. And then, a few hours of sleep and then on to the next place. Movie actors, it's, 12 days when they're recording, and then you have this rest of the year, TV actors, when they're not filming, or movie actors between movies, and here you have this pile of money, and on the other side you have all this time that you have to fill, and they tend to do very expensive things to fill their times with packages from Columbia and stuff. And, you know, so that's why they run out of all their money, you know. And somebody working a job or whatever, if they got a moderate amount of extra income, you know, suddenly manna from heaven, they would, you know, but not enough so that they could quit. In fact, Catherine Helzenberger's character on CSI, who happened to be the secret daughter of one of the mob guys running the casinos, and she finally went to her father to get money for her daughter's education, and she described it to somebody as, now we've got enough money where we can do anything, and not enough money where we can do nothing.
There's a similar character in a series that my family's been watching through, and that's Bones, where one of the guys is secretly the sole inheritor to some mega corporation, and he's made of money. And he has like 3 PhDs and works in a lab studying bugs and slime because that's his thing.
Except now that he doesn't, because a couple seasons ago, the big evil character for the season, you know, said, you know, had a thing like you can either go online and defuse this bomb, or you can stop me as I quietly empty all your accounts, and put all your property in my name and take your car and stuff. So it's, you know, anybody who works with computers, just a completely absurd sequence. You know, it's as bad as when somebody's breaking a password and they get it one letter at a time.
You know, I've pretty much given up the hope of having any realistic technology scenes ever in anything. So
you should watch the movie Sneakers, then. Everything in there is pretty good.
Are you telling me the Hackers was not factual?
Well, they were facts. They were just wrong facts.
There was that one part in the Neutron movie where they put "Who am I" on the command line and it shot out who it was. And I was like, hey, that's actually a thing a computer will actually do.
In The Matrix Reloaded, some of the scenes where Trinity was hacking, she's actually using Nmap, and she's actually exploiting a vulnerability in old versions of SSH. So they have one little snippet of actual real, like, security work.
Ooh. Real hacking is boring.
And in all the CSI shows, every time the computer's printing characters on the screen, there's a little bip for every character, a little bip noise.
My phone does that.
Because that wouldn't drive me crazy.
So you mean I can't hack by flying through a virtual environment like something out of Tron?
No, it's a lot more like Lawnmower Man.
You can, you just have to move to Washington State or Colorado.
Hey, I know this. It's a Unix system.
I know Unix.
And apparently somebody's left a terminal open, because that's the only way you're going to get in.
All right. Does anybody have anything else, or should we wrap up?
Let's bring this thing in for a landing.
Or at least a docking. Did anybody want to close with anything about the audiobook?
I just want to say again what I said earlier, and just, wow.
Yeah, do yourself a favor. Read this one if you haven't. It's definitely worth your time.
I mean, really, listen to us ramble on this long about it and you haven't listened to it, please, please, please do.
And then you need to go to cavalcadeaudio.org.com if you like ribald, irreverent, and completely not safe for work humor, listen through the entire Eddie Case series, and then I think his earliest published, at least online, science fiction work. It's Blue World. I knew it earlier in the cast. But go back to that. That is just brilliant.
I'm going to take it a step further. If you liked this book anywhere near as much as any of us did, head on over to Amazon and do a search for David Collins Rivera and buy the ebook editions, just to kick a couple of bucks his way, just in some way to say thank you. I mean, I know Lost in Bronx. That's not why he did this. You know, it was not for money. This is a labor of love, and he'd much rather just hear you say it, you know, just write him an email and tell him how much you like it, or leave a review on Amazon. But still, I mean, go get the ebook and buy it for, you know, friends of yours who might also want to read it or want to listen to it. It's just, you know, it's worth it. And he's more than earned it. That's all I can say.
And the story, short story, I was trying to think of, was My Blue Heaven, and just it's just mind blowing. I mean, it's an insight into this obsessed person. It's really nothing at all like the Ejok stories, but I think you'll enjoy it as well.
Blue Heaven. My Blue Heaven was a movie, Steve Martin movie.
Okay, Blue Heaven. They'll know what I mean when they get to the site.
Right, right on.
So what are we listening to for next month?
Oh, this was Pegwall's genius idea. Pegwall, are you still with us?
Sure am.
So what's the book you're assigning to us for next month, for October?
Next month is Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft.
I am excitement.
Yeah, I was so excited, I listened to the wrong audiobook.
Are you sure that wasn't Cthulhu just warping your mind to bring him into his clutches?
You didn't say Cthulhu juice three times, did you?
Cthulhu juice, Cthulhu juice.
Can you say Cthulhu?
All right, so clearly nobody said that because nobody can. All right, so we'll meet back here again. Boy, I'm really tired. Meet back here again on October 14th. That'd be Patch Tuesday of October, 7 p.m. Eastern U.S. time on Mumble. We're at, I don't even see the Mumble address. It's on the HPR website. Look it up there. Join the HPR mailing list, the email subscription list, because I always post them there. And you can join us on the show. You can give your opinion on that book at that time, just like Tojet popped in and helped us out with this one. And actually, thanks a lot, Tojet, and to everybody else who showed up this week. This has been a lot of fun. And we're going to do it again next month.
Yeah, the address for the Mumble server is Charlie Hatrack, the number one, .teamspeak.cc, port 64747, and the HPR room, and no password, and whatever you want to call yourself is optional.
Yep, and for anyone who's very new to Mumble, if you ever try to get onto a Mumble server that you've been told does not require a password and it asks you for a password, that's because you've picked a username that someone else has already used on that server. So just pick a different username. If you've been told it does not require a password, then it does not require a password, and that's a username issue, because this one does not require a password, and you should just be able to hop on in here with us. So thanks again, everybody, for listening to Hacker Public Radio. Thank you for sticking with us through the audio book club. We're really hoping you're enjoying the series. We've got some positive feedback from some HPR listeners and even some of the authors whose books we've reviewed. We've gotten some really positive feedback from them, which is a lot of fun. But we're doing it for you, the listener, and we're hoping it will encourage you to either join us on the book club or listen to an audiobook that you haven't heard before, or put out a show for Hacker Public Radio. We can always use new shows. We can always use new hosts. And you've got something to say, and we're dying to hear it. So with that, I will say good night to everybody. Have a good one, guys.
Night, folks.
Later.
Good night.
Good night.
Jeez. Good night.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org.
We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday.
Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is.
Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com.
If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.
So you recorded this, right, Pokey?
Yeah, you can see the little red dot next to my name this time.